We ask for your cooperation in maintaining decorum and civility throughout this hearing. For the safety, security, and comfort of all attendees, please note the following guidelines. Signs are not permitted in the hearing room. Verbal outbursts, shouting, or disruptive behavior will not be tolerated. Applause and other audible demonstrations are not allowed. Standing or sitting in walkways and aisles is prohibited. If you require any accommodation, please speak to the staff sergeant staff wearing gold ties. State troopers and house security personnel are present to ensure everyone's safety. Those providing testimony will be given time limits, which must be strictly observed. If you receive an entrance ticket, please retain it, as it may be required for re-entry if you leave the hearing room. Failure to comply with these guidelines may result in the removal from the hearing room. Our goal is to conduct this hearing efficiently while ensuring everyone the opportunity to observe and participate appropriately. The next order of business is approval of the minutes. Representative Bliss, you were here early and reviewed them back in front. Would you like to move the minutes?
I have studiously reviewed the minutes, and I move them forward, please.
Perfect. Thank you. Any discussion on the minutes? Seeing none, those in favor of approval of the minutes, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. The minutes are adopted. So what we're going to do first, we're going to do a little bit of switching up in the order, and Representative Chair Moeller and I are going to finish presenting 4075, House Bill 4075. Where we left off yesterday was just a walkthrough by Mr. Diebel of the changes to the bill, and so we will...
So House File 4075 is the next bill. Representative Moeller, would you like to move House File 4075 to get it before the committee? And the motion will be that it be recommended to pass and be placed on the general register.
Yes,
Representative
thanks, Madam
Moeller.
Chair.
Okay, so that has been moved. And then I understand there is, Chair Scott, you have a DE2 amendment. Would you like to move the amendment?
Yes, I would like to move the DE2 amendment, Madam Chair.
All right. Did you want to explain it first, or should we adopt it and then go through it as?
I think we can just go ahead and adopt it, because Mr. Diebel did yesterday, he walked through the actual DE2. So.
All right. That's great. So the DE2 amendment is before us. All in favor of adoption of the DE2 amendment, please say aye.
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 Any opposed? The motion prevails. The DE2 amendment is adopted. So is there anything else that the two of you would like to do to present the bill? Maybe just like to remind us, since this was, I think a number of members weren't in the room when the bill was described.
Sure. I'm hoping that they still have the contents of the packet from yesterday. Do you guys still have that? There's a new story in there by Care 11, and they did a follow-up story a few years after the 2015 law was made to have these petitions or court orders when someone is found guilty of domestic abuse to turn over their firearms. And there's a really good story, a three-part story that Care 11 did on the follow-up to that bill, and they found like in less than 2% of the cases were these hearings happening and firearms were actually being turned over. So that was kind of the genesis of the bill. I did a bill several years ago, about 6 years ago, to just have a follow-up hearing to ensure that those were turned over. And so what we've worked on here is a collaborative effort for that. And I'll let Chair Moeller explain what she did this summer and in relation to what we're doing here today.
Thank you. Chair Moeller.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. So after the Burnsville shooting, one of the bills that we passed was a task force to examine removal of guns from abusers. And the task force made a number of recommendations. Some were legislative, some were not, some were systems changes. And so, you know, one of the things that they recommended was to do more with respect to these court orders that Chair Scott mentioned. And so we took that information, worked with nonpartisan, crafted a different bill, and we were able to pass both bills out of public safety and merge them here today in a format that I think we're both really satisfied with and keeps the spirit of the task force recommendations as well.
Well, wonderful. Thank you so much. Thank you so much for working together on this and getting it to a really good place. So is there any discussion? Well, first of all, are there any testifiers? You don't have any other testifiers on the bill. Okay. And is there any member of the public who wishes to testify on this bill? All right, seeing none, member discussion. All right, Representative Engen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just want to thank you both for your joint work on this. It's been awesome to see.
All right, well, wonderful. So Chair Moeller is renewing her motion that House File 4075 as amended be recommended to pass and placed on the General Register. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Any opposed? Motion prevails. On its way. Thank you very much.
Thank you. The next bill before us is House File 3825. Representative Rapinski, please take a seat at the table. It's great to have you with us this morning. I will move House File 3825 that it pass and be recommended to be placed on the General Register. Go ahead with your beginning of your bill, the testimony on your bill.
Thank you, Chair Scott and fellow representatives. House File 3825 is a DPS Office of Justice Programs policy bill. The OJP division at DPS provides leadership and resources to reduce crime, improve the functioning of the criminal justice system, and assist crime victims. 3825 makes a few technical corrections and enhances crime victim rights by ensuring victims are notified of plea hearing and sentencing hearings, protecting victims' identities in certain prosecutor petition documents, and requiring that victims be notified if an offense is eligible for automatic expungement. This bill provides important protections for crime victims in Minnesota. I have with me OJP Director Kim Babine to provide more details on the bill if needed. Thank you.
Perfect. Go ahead and introduce yourself for the tape and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Scott. Kim Babine, I am Executive Director of the Office of Justice Programs. I'll provide a brief overview, but happy to answer more questions if there are more questions. So Section 1, I'm going to go through actually the technical pieces first and then the crime victim rights, so it's going to be a little bit out of order. But starting with Section 1, this relates to protection of victim identity in sentence adjustments. The proposal would eliminate the requirement that a victim be specifically identified in a prosecutor's petition for a sentence adjustment. Currently, when prosecutors petition for a sentence adjustment, they are required to include the victim's name. In Section 2, that relates to privacy protections for minor victims. The proposal would expand the protections over victim identity to include the crime of using a minor in a sexual performance. The proposal amends Section 609.3471, which protects the identity of minor victims of crimes related to sexual assault, abuse, and exploitation. The use of a minor in a sexual performance is a crime that falls into that category of crimes, and these victims should be similarly protected. Now, skipping to Section 5, protection against employer retaliation. It would expand the protection against employer retaliation provided to victims of crime to include victims of stalking. The crime of stalking is consistent with other crimes listed under the definition of violent crime. The final two provisions are related to crime victim rights. Sections 3 and 7 would expand the circumstances where a prosecutor is required to notify the victim that an offense is eligible for automatic expungement. Currently, prosecutors notify victims if an offense is eligible for automatic expungement when they have a proposed plea agreement. The same information is necessary for other case outcomes. Sections 3, 4, and 6 would establish a procedure during plea and sentencing hearings that places a requirement on the judge to inquire of the prosecutor if victims have been notified of the hearing, are present, have received their statutorily required notifications, and if they wish to be heard. The purpose of this proposal is to ensure that victims' rights and presence are recognized in the courtroom, and that those that wish to have input are given that opportunity. That concludes my overview. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you so much. Is there anyone in the audience wishing to testify on this bill? Seeing none, we will move to member questions. Chair Liebling.
Yeah, thank you. Thanks for bringing the bill, Representative Rapinski. I just wonder, if the testifier, have you had discussions with the courts and with the county attorneys about the notification procedures? And it seems to put a little bit of additional burden on the court. And I suppose that's one of the reasons it's here. Mm-hmm. So I'd just kind of like to know if everybody who's impacted by this, obviously I'm not talking about the victims, but talking about the prosecutors and the courts, are they okay with these changes?
Ms. Babine.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Chair Liebling. There have been some discussions with the county attorneys. We have not received any concerns from them, but they are aware of the bill at this time. I don't know about conversations with the courts. I would have to. I don't think we've had specific conversations with them.
Chair Liebling.
Okay. Well, thank you for that. Well, I mean, there's still time as the bill moves along, and mm-hmm. I just, you know, just saying, here we are in Judiciary Committee. If the courts do have any concerns, I hope they'll let us know. Otherwise, I guess we have to assume that everything is okay with them. So, thank you.
Any other member questions or concerns? All right. Well, we certainly appreciate this bill and how it protects those child victims especially. It's a really important piece of legislation, so thank you, Rep. Rapinski, for carrying it. Seeing no other discussion, I will renew my motion that House File 3825 be passed and referred to the General Register. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. The bill is on its way to the GR. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
The next bill, Representative Witte, House File 3826. Welcome to the committee, Representative Witte, and Representative Steer moves House File 3826, and the motion is that it be placed on the General Register. Would you like to go to the bill first or the amendment, Representative Witte?
We can go to the amendment really quick.
All right. Members, we had an author's amendment that was offered a little bit late. Both chairs agreed, in light of this being deadline week, that we would take the amendment. So, to your amendment, Representative Witte.
So, when we had the hearing in the public safety and then in state government, we've been working with Representative Pinot to fix some of the language, and with Superintendent Evans, and that's what you have in front of us. Our researcher, nonpartisan researcher, Ben Johnson's been working with us, and we came to an agreement this morning. So that's the final wording for the bill, if he wants to explain what it does.
Okay. Mr. Johnson, if you want to explain what the amendment does in relation to the bill.
Madam Chair and members, this deals with two provisions that are in the bill right now that relate to an administrative subpoena. Very briefly, an administrative subpoena is a document that typically prosecutors can use to obtain additional information. It's an alternative to a warrant. It's often issued on a lower standard than a warrant. A warrant is probable cause. An administrative subpoena can typically be issued anytime there is an active and legitimate investigation into a potential crime that's going on. What this amendment does is that it inserts that probable cause standard into the administrative subpoena language for this purpose. That exists right now in the county attorney statute for a few things, including wage theft investigations. So this would treat this much like the wage theft investigation, so that if a county attorney or an attorney general as a prosecutor was working with law enforcement and was going to issue an administrative subpoena to obtain this information, they would have to make a showing that there is probable cause that one of these crimes has been committed.
Thank you for that really good explanation. Any member discussion on the amendment? Seeing none, all those in Oh, wait. Oh, Representative, or Chair Mueller, sorry.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to say thank you to the Superintendent, Representative Witte, Chair Pinto for working on that language. We appreciate it, and we plan to match it up in public safety, too. Thanks.
Thank you. All right, any further member discussion on the amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor of the passage of the A1 amendment to House File 3828, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. The amendment is adopted. To your bill, Representative Witte.
Thank you, Chair Scott and Chair Liebling, for hearing this and giving that explanation. House File 3826 is a Be Safe policy bill related to the work of the Be Safe Financial Crimes and Fraud Section. The bill would provide additional tools to the Be Safe in its fight against all types of fraud in Minnesota. The bill expands identity theft to include AI or technology-based duplication of someone's likeness and extends the statute of limitations for some types of fraud-related crimes. The extension is important due to the complex nature of these crimes and helps ensure fraudsters are held accountable. I have Superintendent Drew Evans from the BCA with me to provide more information about the bill.
Welcome to the committee. Mr. Evans, go ahead and introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Scott, members of the committee. My name is Drew Evans. I'm the superintendent of the Minnesota Bureau of Criminal Apprehension. And as Representative Winnie outlined, these provisions that are before you today are provisions that will assist us in combating all types of fraud across Minnesota as our BCA Financial Crimes and Fraud Section works to combat insurance fraud, wage theft, traditional financial crimes, and then state program fraud. The first one that's been alluded to, and Mr. Johnson aptly explained, the purpose of subpoenas in our financial crimes investigations would expand some of the pieces that would allow us to further investigations more quickly as we're doing that to provide more specific items as to what we're seeking in those investigations. And as noted, the amendment really aligns, as Representative Pinto noted, wage theft more analogous with the types of crimes that we're asking to investigate here as compared to some of the others that this is utilized for. And so that's why we're in agreement that we can make that, because it's more important to us to have the items that we're looking for and to tie it to the appropriate standard that you're all comfortable with. The second piece is expansion of identity theft. This is really preparing us for the expansion of AI that we're continuing to see. We're already seeing examples of AI being utilized in fraud, and so it's expanding the definition to encompass the wrongful use, a duplication of a person's voice or likeness, including their digital likeness, and we are starting to see those. There's one example, not from Minnesota, thankfully, where an individual was at a recent meeting, obtained a job, and then filed for workers' compensation insurance, and they never existed. They obtained a job, they were hired, they then filed all as a digital likeness and AI, and so this is going to help us pursue that as we're all going to be up against AI-involved frauds across the spectrum of different types of activities we're involved with. And then the last one is expanding the statute of limitations to these delineated crimes that we're seeing. As you're seeing in the work that you're all engaged in all types of combating fraud across both the enterprise or state government, but also in the private sector, that these are often long-term cases that are going, so we're providing clarification to ensure that we hold people accountable and have the time to do that. It doesn't happen often, but sometimes due to the length of these investigations, we run up or surpass the statute of limitations for most of these cases, which is 3 years now. It would expand that to 7 years so that somebody doesn't get away simply because they ran out the clock on the statute of limitations, and I'd be happy to answer any questions of any members.
Thank you for that explanation. Is there anyone in the audience wishing to testify for or against this bill? Seeing none, we'll go to member questions. Anyone have questions? Chair Liebling.
Yeah, thank you very much for bringing this bill, and thank you, Superintendent Evans. Just to be clear, the changes in the bill that are to help deal with fraud, those are helpful to deal with fraud against anybody, right? So this also helps for fraud that might be against government. Am I right?
Mr. Evans.
Chair Scott and Chair Liebling, yes, it's everything. So as noted, our financial crimes and fraud section does fraud involving our state government programs, but we do all types of fraud. And so this is aimed at all of that work to ensure they have the tools needed and necessary for that team to be successful.
Chair Liebling,
thank you. Thank you for that. And I just really... No, it's important to just flag that we are passing bills that deal with fraud against government from all kinds of directions, and this is just one more. We've had some other ones in this committee, and grateful to you, Representative, for carrying this bill. Thank you.
Any other member questions? Seeing none. Representative Witte, final words.
Thank you for hearing this bill on a jam-packed week, and I just appreciate your support.
Perfect. I will renew my, Representative Steer that made the motion. Representative Steer renews his motion that House File 3826 as amended be passed and referred to the General Register. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. The bill is on its way. Thank you. The next bill on the agenda is House File 3827. Representative Duran. Representative Duran, would you like to move your bill? And the motion would be that it be passed and referred to the General Register.
Yes, Chair.
Okay, that is the motion. Go ahead and tell us about your bill.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, committee, for allowing me to speak on House File 3827 today. This is a BCA clarification bill on some crime data and law enforcement reimbursement. So I will hand it off to my testifier because he is way more versed in this than I am.
All right. Superintendent Evans, please reintroduce yourself for the tape and go ahead.
Thank you, Chair Scott, and members of the committee. Again, my name is Drew Evans. I'm the superintendent of the Minnesota Bureau of Criminal Apprehension, and we're grateful for Representative Duran carrying. This is what we're referring to as a technical fix bill for some of the provisions related to the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension. The first is you provide, as a legislature, a fund that is a fund that allows us to reimburse local law enforcement agencies in particular for a variety of particular investigations they're doing, but it's most often used in what is considered a long-term, unanticipated law enforcement investigation where there's a considerable expense. I'll give an example of where this is used. This past year, they had the unfortunate situation in Anoka County where the sheriff's office and many of us, FBI, BC, and a number of local agencies assisted in locating a child that had been murdered in a landfill. They incurred considerable expense, $1 million+ in that situation. This fund can be used to offset that. However, the language in the current statute is that it's grant funding, and it doesn't really align. It really is a reimbursement fund for expenses they incurred. There's still a process that we document they have to go through, but because of the word grant being there and all the focus we've had across the enterprise with grants, there's additional requirements that don't really align with a grant and, say, a competitive grant process. So this is simply replacing the word grant with reimbursement. All the other provisions remain. That proper, you know, accounting principles would be there. We have to go through that. It's documented, it's requested, and we go through that process. So that's for that. The second is peace officer record keeping. This is a very dated statute. For example, it tells peace officers they must keep a record of all crimes committed within their jurisdiction, the individual. Now we do NIBRS-based reporting, which is national incident-based reporting. We are not losing any reporting. In fact, we do far more than would be illustrated in the statute. And so it's aligning with that because we are getting questions from our partners. Do we need to do both of these? It's causing some confusion as people are looking at their statutory requirements. So it's changing that and that. And then one unforeseen consequence, when the Clean Slate bill was passed out of here, there is not a provision when both the judiciary and the BCA agree a record was sealed in error to be able to automatically unseal that if we have agreement on that. You need to go in front of a judge and request an order to do that. This most often happens if there's a technical glitch within the software that then is identified most often by the courts who notify us and we agree it was sealed in error. It would allow us to unseal that record without having to go in front of a judge. And then lastly, The order for protections, you pass a new law creating a vulnerable adult order for protection related to vulnerable adults. This creates alignment with other types of order for protections that those orders would be passed from the judiciary to the BCA, much in the same way that a traditional OFP, domestic abuse, no contact order would be passed so that it's available electronically to law enforcement. Right now, that is not required in statute, and so we're asking that that be placed in so that they are passed the same way so they're available electronically to law enforcement across Minnesota. So that is the overview of the bill. And again, Madam Chair, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Superintendent. Is there anyone in the audience that wishes to testify? All right, seeing none, we'll move to member questions. Chair Liebling.
Yes, I'm the question asker today.
You are, that's fine.
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you for the bill. And So I do have a question about that sealed records piece, Superintendent. And the question I have is, right now, if that happens and you have to go to a judge, I assume that the person whose record is erroneously sealed is notified and has an opportunity to be heard, you know. I mean, so here's a concern. You know, it's fine to say, well, this only happens if there's an error, but whether there's an error is the question, right? And so I have a little bit of heartburn about if the person who is the subject of this order is cut out of the process by the bill.
Superintendent Evans.
Chair Scott and Chair Liebling, it's a good question. There is not a notification process. That is part of the Clean Slate bill. And the reason is we don't have contact information for the people that are associated with this. Just as a recap for everybody, you know, in here, there's about 16 million records in our criminal history system. They had to be mapped to 16,600 different statutes. It's been an incredibly difficult process for us to go through. About 2 million of those records are eligible for sealing. Because of the large volume and the lack of contact information, there is not notice. So we wouldn't, for your concern, I don't know that I can address it. There would not be notice in that situation, but the courts and the BCA would both look at it and agree that it was sealed in error in that process. So that this was a, the workaround is now we go in front of a judge, but they still wouldn't have notice even in front of the judge. It's something that would be brought by the courts and the BCA.
Chair Liebling.
Okay. So, well, thanks. That sort of does alleviate the concern. So it's not taking away anybody's notice that they currently have. So, okay. Great. I'm fine with that. And then I had one other question about the reporting of the crime reporting piece that you were discussing. And I'm just wondering, do we have the same, as a state, we have the same access to the data as we, under this change, as we do currently?
Superintendent Evans.
Chair Scott, Chair Liebling, good question. You have more access to data than what the provision is that we're working on here. The NIBRS reporting that we have currently, National Incident-Based Reporting System, which is the consistent standard by the FBI across the United States, is much more robust than the piece that we're repealing.
Okay.
So, Chair Liebling.
Thank you. Thank you for that. And I just wonder because, you know, now that we, right now, we can't count on our federal partners to share information with us. And I just... You know, when I heard you discuss it, I just had the concern that I hope that doesn't mean that we could possibly lose access to our own information. And you're saying that can't happen, even if, say, they've suddenly decided they wanted to punish Minnesota and not let us have access to our information? They couldn't cut us off from it?
Superintendent Evans.
Chair Scott, Chair Liebling, excellent question, and I can provide very good clarification. The reporting that is still required, we utilize the NIBRS standard in Minnesota for our law enforcement partners, but their duty to report is to the BCA, and then we are the pass-through to the FBI. So we maintain that data. There's a crime data explorer that the BCA maintains. That's our Minnesota data that you're accessing, and then we pass to the FBI. But all of the data is our data, even though we're using that national standard. So we will not lose it. There's no chance of losing it because the collection is still based on the BCA superintendent requirements of crime reporting by our local law enforcement partners.
Great.
Chair Liebling.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Appreciate it.
Any other member questions? All right. Seeing none, Representative Duran renews his motion that House File 3827 be passed and referred to the General Register. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, same sign. The bill's on its way. Thank you, Representative Duran. And now we're going to switch gavels here. Yes. Do you want me to move?
I think she can stay here. If we
okay.
Can
yep. Oh, yeah. Yeah. It's a left-handed gavel.
Yeah.
And if you're sitting in that chair. I just kind of like a left-handed crowbar that my dad used to tease me about.
Me a chance here to hold the gavel. I'm excited.
Adjourn Hansen.
Representative Hansen. The next bill on the agenda is HF 4200, Representative Hansen. Not being a member of the committee, I will move that HF 4200 be re-referred to the General Register. And you have an amendment. Would you like to move the amendment?
Correct, Chair. I have a an A1 amendment that gets the bill in the shape I would like. It was a correction that nonpartisan staff caught because they're smarter than me, and they wanted to just fix it while I was here.
All right. I will move the A1 amendment. Do you want to explain the A1 or just adopt it into the...
It just gets it in the bill, the shape I would like, Chair.
Okay. Great. Any discussion to the amendment? All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. Representative Hansen, to your bill.
As amended. Thank you, Chair. Hi, members. I think this is the first time I've been in your committee and I didn't bring snacks and I'm so sorry, so please forgive me, chairs. I apologize. House File 4200 clarifies that the status of a cannabis application and the data is which information is public data. It clarifies that an applicant's social equity status is non-public data, that metric data is considered non-public data, and that the description of sites, security, operations, accounting, compliance, and data in the vehicle disclosure forms is also non-public data. For obvious reasons, we want to make sure that we're not putting all that data out there of a dispensary or a cultivation's security plans and things like that, obviously, to make sure that they stay secure. So that is the entirety of my bill. This is a part of the Office of Cannabis Management's agency bill, and it will just help them determine which data is and is not public. So thank you so much.
Thank you, Representative Hansen. Looks like you have a testifier.
Yes.
Go ahead and introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Chair Scott, as well. My name is Eric Taubel. I'm the Executive Director for the Minnesota Office of Cannabis Management. This bill, I think, is really important for us as we think about actually actualizing the market and understanding the business needs of our license holders. In order to ensure that cannabis doesn't make its way into illicit or gray markets or our neighboring states that have prohibited cannabis, we track and trace every piece of cannabis from the point of its planting to the point of its sale. And included in that is a number of transactions between businesses that are the kind of data that competitors would really love to be able to have a handle on. If you could see what your competitors were selling at wholesale prices, how much, what volumes, what products were moving, that would be incredibly beneficial in a competitive market. And so what this does is ensures that that data is treated as non-public to protect business data and business interests. The office has maintained a high standard of public transparency. In January, we launched a market dashboard that aggregates this data and then makes it readily available to the people of Minnesota to see exactly how much money is being purchased in the adult use, the medical markets. We also track the price per gram in both markets, which is an interesting metric that a lot of states use. So we're really committed to ensuring that we protect business data while also making sure that Minnesotans have access to that aggregate level data to see what's happening in our markets. And then I think the other thing that we wanted to make sure we do is that as part of the application process, because again, we're dealing with a federally illegal substance, we require businesses to provide security site plans to show us how their security is set up, where the cameras are, and where the sort of rooms are that are storing cannabis products. As you might imagine, having that be public data would be somewhat counterintuitive to the purpose of protecting these facilities with high-tech cameras and high-tech alarm systems. So it's a pretty straightforward set of amendments that we think reflect the needs of the market as we start to grow. Thank you.
Thank you, Director. Are there any members of the public who would like to testify? Seeing none, we'll go to member discussion. Any members? Chair Scott.
Thank you, Chair. So I just want to say thank you to the director for reaching out and not only running this by my office, but working with MnOG. And I thank you for just listening to their expertise as this bill was moving forward. I think you got it right. So it's a good balance. Thank you.
Seeing no further discussion, I will renew the motion that HF 4200 as amended be referred to the General Register.
That's fine, too.
Would you like any final comments?
Thank you, Chair. Wherever you'd like to send this one, we have a package of bills that we're doing. So Ways and Means, General Register, lay it over. We will figure it out. But I'm open to what your committee feels is best and for your committee. I got to be the most flexible legislator that's offering that.
Yeah. Well, I believe that we believe the General Register is the best place for this to go. Yeah, Representative Chair Liebling.
Yeah, thank you. And thank you for all your work in this space. Representative Hansen, it's really, really doing a service for the state by the work that you do. So if there's a larger bill and it's on a different path, it kind of doesn't matter if this portion is in it and it's the same, or if you're going to amend it to be the same, it really doesn't matter. If we send this to the General Register, it has cleared, the data portion has cleared this committee, and then it doesn't really matter where this little piece of it goes. So I just wanted to clarify that. I think we're fine to send it. Or, you know, even if we, yeah, go ahead. I'm sorry.
Thank you, Chair and Co-Chair and Co-Chairs. If I could, it always helps to have vehicle bills kind of give us options as we go. So going to Ways and Means would be great just to kind of park it there. And then I can talk to all of the wonderful chairs in that committee should we need to make any amendments or if Chair Scott comes up with anything fabulous that I need to amend in, then we could do that. But it would be great if we could just park it at Ways and Means if you're comfortable doing that.
Thank you, Representative Hansen. It looks like that will be fine. So I will amend my motion. I don't know if I amend it or just change it, but to re-refer HF4200 to Ways and Means. No further discussion. All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you.
The next bill on the agenda is HF3908 from Representative Kraft. Welcome to the committee, Representative Kraft. I will move HF3908 to be referred to the General Register. Thank you. Representative Kraft, if you'd like to present your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Nice to be back here. This is a Department of Public Safety Driver and Vehicle Services policy proposal. HF3908 does two things, makes technical corrections to the ignition interlock device program, no new policy, and adds some new privacy protections for optional driver's license and ID indicators. On interlock, the main thing it does is clarifies program eligibility for individuals with out-of-state DWI convictions to avoid legal ambiguity. And on the privacy side, it strengthens privacy protections for these optional driver's license and ID indicators related to medical alerts, autism, and certain mental health conditions by classifying this information as private data. The changes are aimed to simplify administration of the interlock program and strengthen protections for sensitive personal information while supporting emergency responders. With that, I will turn it over to Director Zhang if he has any comments.
Thank you, Director. Go ahead and introduce yourself and present your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Pong Zhang, Director of the Driver and Vehicle Services Division, and thank you, Representative Kraft, for carrying the bill and also for walking through it so thoroughly. I'll stand for any questions. I'll just add maybe one thing that the two indicators that are getting the extra protections are the mental health indicator and the autism indicator that are currently eligible to be placed on the driver's license. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there any members of the public who would like to testify on the bill? Seeing none, we'll go to member discussion. Representative Engen, I believe.
Yeah, thank you, Chair. This is my question. So what are all of the identifiers that could potentially be on a driver's license that or an ID at all that would now be considered private data? In other words, what is going from public to private? Is there a list of everything?
Director?
Madam Chair, Representative Engen, I can provide or we can follow up with a full list. Most indicators are by default private on individuals. This is more of a belt and suspenders to just make sure there's no confusion about the data categorization of it. But my understanding of it is that anything that is related to the individual is already considered private, but it's just not quite spelled out clearly. That's what these changes will do to make sure that these indicators are clearly private. The only designation on here that is has a federal restriction is the firearms training indicator, and then with this change, we also add the autism indicator and the mental health indicator with the federal restriction.
Representative Engen?
No further follow-up. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Feist.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was just thinking as I was reading this language that it just sort of exemplifies the complexity around the Data Practices Act and the need for us to do a deep dive at some point as a legislature to think about where we've come since 1973 and some more universal changes we might want to make, because this is really complicated, and it seems really clear that this data should be non-public data. So thanks for bringing it.
Any further member discussion? Seeing none, the chair renews her motion that HF 3908, the first engrossment, be referred to the general register. All those in favor, aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails.
Thank you very much.
I'm getting it. The next bill on the agenda is HF 3495 from Representative Feist. Representative Feist, would you like to move HF 3459 be referred to the general register?
Yes, that is my motion.
Thank you. It looks like there is an amendment. Would you like to move the A2 amendment?
Yes, I would like to move the A2 amendment.
And discussion before?
Sure. This amendment clarifies language defining first mortgage and first mortgagee, and it also delays implementation of this law at the request of Representative Norris and related. He has another bill, and this would align with that bill. I don't know if I explained. It's pretty innocuous, if you'd like to explain.
Please introduce yourself for the record. And
thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Tom Bray. I am the chair of the Minnesota State Bar Association Common Interest Ownership Act Committee. I think the amendment delays the effective date of Minnesota Statutes Chapter 508C, which is the co-op bill, not this bill.
Oh, yeah. That's right. Thank you.
Well, thank you for the clarification, Chair. Any member discussion to the amendment? Seeing none, all in favor, say aye.
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 Opposed? The motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. Representative Feist, to your bill.
Great. Thank you so much. Thank you, committee. Since we're running ahead of time, I'll just describe all of the 97 pages in front of you. Page one. This bill is 97 pages, but 90 of those pages simply correct inaccurate or incomplete cross-references within the statute. So it's not as dense as it looks. And this bill is modifying the Minnesota Common Interest Ownership Act. And unlike some other bills relating to the same act, this one is not controversial, as far as I know. The changes contained in this bill originated from the Bar Association Committee that is made up of attorneys, like my testifier, representatives of all of the stakeholders in common interest communities, including developers, associations, property managers, and unit owners. This bill has also been vetted by Legal Aid. And there are many clarifying and technical changes as well. And with me is Attorney Tom Bray, who is an expert and will also be testifying.
Thank you, Representative Feist. Chair Bray, please reintroduce yourself for the record and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Tom Bray. I'm the chair of the MCIOA Committee of the Minnesota State Bar Association's Real Property Law Section. First, with respect to the corrections in the cross-references, just to defend our committee, the bill's cross-references were accurate when the bill was adopted, but over the years, the bill's been amended many, many times, and often as a result of those amendments, the internal cross-references in the statute have become inaccurate. So this is intended to correct those and bring them up to date. There are a few substantive changes in the act, and I believe you all have a handout that summarizes them. I will run through that just real quickly. The current act exempts certain types of common interest communities, which are created primarily for dealing with rights related to access, utilities, and parking. There's been a question out there among lawyers as to whether that exemption would be lost if one were to include provisions relating to property insurance and reconstruction after a casualty loss. Our committee looked at that, and we think that at least in the commercial context where the consumer protection needs are not as great, that it is okay for those types of common interest communities to deal with insurance and reconstruction without losing that exemption. So this amendment affects that. Secondly, the existing statute requires various actions, amendments to declarations, amendments to bylaws, termination of a common interest community, to be approved by a certain number or a certain percentage of the unit owners or the members of the association. The question is, how do we evidence that approval for purposes of recording documents in the land records? There's a provision in the statute that provides that the evidence of the necessary approvals can be obtained by recording an affidavit of the president or another officer of the association, evidencing that the necessary approvals have been obtained. Unfortunately, the existing language doesn't match up with the requirements of all the necessary sections in the statute, so we've kind of fine-tuned that just to make sure that there's no inconsistencies as to what's required. Third, shortly after 515B was initially adopted, the registrars of title around the state dealing with the Torrens system wanted to add some additional requirements for dealing with common interest communities that are created on Torrens property. Unfortunately, rather than amending the statute, they elected to achieve that by amending the general rules of practice of the district courts. So those rules currently reside in the general rules of practice of the district courts, where I can testify from personal experience, no transactional lawyer ever looks at the general rules of practice of the district courts. So those rules are often overlooked with respect to Torrens property. So we're trying to pull those into the statute so that they're more apparent to practitioners. There's language in the current statute that says an amendment or a supplemental declaration is not effective until it's recorded. That is being amended to clarify that in order to be effective, it not only needs to be recorded, but one also needs to record evidence that any required unit owner or mortgagee approvals have been obtained, and that refers back to that affidavit I was talking about earlier. The Act currently requires that if an amendment to a CIC declaration changes something that is designated as a limited common element, which all unit owners would have a right to use, to a limited common element, which only specified unit owners would have a right to use, there needs to be an amended common interest community plat needs to be recorded. There are, however, certain types of limited common elements which the statute does not require to be shown on a common interest community plat. So this amendment qualifies that requirement to say that if the new limited common elements being created are not required to be shown on a common interest community plat, then no amended common interest community plat is required. Most homeowner associations in Minnesota are set up or incorporated. There's a Minnesota Nonprofit Corporation Act. The Minnesota Nonprofit Corporation Act has a provision that says that the board of directors of a nonprofit corporation must have a minimum of 3 directors. That's a little cumbersome to deal with in common interest communities that may only have 2 units. And so this one of the things this bill does is adds language that says, with respect to a common interest community that has fewer than 3 units, the number of directors on the board can equal the number of units. The current bill or current statute has requirements relating to liability insurance for the association. Those requirements require the association to maintain primary liability insurance in the event of a claim relating to common elements or limited common elements. That would mean that the association's insurance policy is the first to respond to that claim. We think that creates an inequitable result in some commercial condominiums where limited common elements are often used to designate outdoor patio spaces, for example, in restaurants. And in those situations, we think it would be appropriate to allow the declaration to say that the unit owner's liability insurance has to be primary rather than the association's liability insurance, so that claims resulting from this commercial use as a restaurant, for example, don't cause the association to have an adverse liability history on their insurance. And then lastly, in 2017, the statute was amended to require homeowners associations to develop a maintenance plan, a maintenance budget, and a maintenance schedule, and it requires that the association make those documents available to all unit owners and to all initial purchasers of units. But the 2017 amendments overlooked the need to get those documents in the hand of prospective purchasers. So one of the things this bill does is amends the provisions relating to the documentation that a seller is required to provide to a buyer to include a copy of this maintenance plan, maintenance schedule, and maintenance budget. Are there any questions?
Any questions for the testifier? Representative Feist.
Can I ask a question about my own bill? I would just like to clarify on the primary liability insurance. When you talk about the unit owner, then are we referring to like a restaurant owner?
Yes. So if the oftentimes what happens is the interior part of the restaurant would be a unit, and then the adjacent exterior patio area would be a limited common element assigned to that unit. And we want the owner of the restaurant to be the primary liability insurer, not the association.
Chair Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you to the testifier for this. Something you just said made me wonder. So, and maybe you could tell me where it is in the bill, but if the if a prospective seller has to provide these documents to a buyer or to an interested buyer, which makes sense, what happens if they can't get those documents? I mean, sometimes the homeowners association, you know, maybe hasn't provided them. I mean, it assumes that everybody's got what they should have, and I don't know what would happen. I just don't want to put a burden on I think it's a good idea, what you just described, but I don't know if we would want to put a burden on a seller if they can't get those documents. What happens? They can't sell?
Yeah, Member Weidling, or Chair Weidling, two things. First of all, the existing statute requires the association to make those documents available to the unit owners. And secondly, there are a number of other documents which the seller has to obtain from the association to provide to the buyer. There's a document called a real estate transfer disclosure statement, which the association is required by statute to fill out to provide information regarding their budget and, you know, other claims and things of that nature. So there's a necessary interaction between the seller, the buyer, and the association. And if the association is, for whatever reason, not cooperative, let's say they're not functioning, it's going to cause bigger problems than with just this maintenance plan, maintenance schedule, and maintenance budget.
Okay.
Madam Chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, okay. Well, that does give me some comfort. So we're not creating a new problem. We might be
Correct.
Adding a little bit to an existing problem, but at least not creating a new one. I do have another question, too. When we adopted the amendment, it went by pretty fast, but you made reference to the fact that we're extending the effective date for another bill or another statute. Could you kind of repeat what we were doing with that in the amendment and why we're doing that?
Mr. Bray. Representative Feist.
This was in collaboration with Representative Norris and approved by the Minnesota State Bar Association. And did you want to?
Chair Weidling. So Minnesota Statutes 308C was adopted, I believe, 2 years ago. Was originally to be effective in 2024. That year, that was extended to 2025. There's been attempts by the parties proposing that bill and working on that language to interact with the bar, but their copy of the bill didn't come through till January. It's a 50-page bill. There's a lot of work to be done to integrate that bill into this 515B, because it's what it's purporting to do is to take cooperatives out of Chapter 515B and govern them by 308C, which is fine, but the two bills need, the two statutes need to work with one another, and we just haven't had time to accomplish that yet.
Madam Chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. That's fine. We don't need Mr. Blake to explain further. That's good. Thanks.
Okay. Ms. Davis, did you want to clarify anything? Okay. Are there any members of the public interested in testifying? I didn't get that. Further member discussion? Representative Van Binsbergen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question is around the maintenance records on properties that are to be sold. What stage of the process is a buyer going to get that information? How's, you know, and is that for anybody that signs a purchase agreement, or do they have to be? Is there a time frame, a window of that?
Yeah, Mr. Yes. Bray.
Representative, there isn't a required time frame. The time frame is derived from the fact that a buyer has 10 days to terminate a purchase agreement from the date they receive these materials. So a seller could choose to give these materials to the buyer before a purchase agreement is signed, so that once the purchase agreement is signed, it can't be terminated. But I think the common practice is to wait until have the purchase agreement be signed, provide these documents to the buyer, then the buyer has 10 days to review them and to terminate the purchase agreement if they don't like them.
Representative Van Binsbergen, and to the member that the chair is to be referred to as Chair Finke or Madam Chair. Thank you. Continue, Representative.
Thank you, Chair Finke. Is there any extra work that's required of the homeowner of that board, the association board? Are they just producing more copies of what they've already provided to the current homeowners? Is it a new responsibility that the associations have to apply by, and are they mandated to do?
I think in today's world, most of these documents are online. Most associations, either through their own website or through their management company's websites, have them available online. It's not a new document being prepared. If it is an association that doesn't have their documents available online, then there would be additional copies that would have to be made of a paper document. But again, that requirement already exists in the fact that they're required to give these to all the unit owners. So even without this amendment, the unit owner could request a copy and then give it to their buyer.
Thank you. Representative Van Binsbergen.
Thank you.
Yeah. Any further member discussion? Seeing none, Representative Feist renews her motion that HF 3459 as amended be re-referred to the General Register. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Oh, I apologize. Closing comments, okay. Representative Feist.
I was just going to thank the Bar Association and Mr. Bray and his colleagues. This is one of those bills, you know, it's 97 pages of meticulous work, and it's not like the sexiest bill that, you know, makes all the headlines, but I just always really appreciate, maybe it is. Anyway, I just appreciate your work and just appreciate bills like this, so thanks for hearing it.
Thank you, Representative Feist. And now we will renew your motion that HF 3459, as amended, be re-referred to the General Register. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails and the bill is passed.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
This is the last one. The final bill on the agenda is HF 3711, Representative Curran. Representative Curran moves that HF 3711 be re-referred to the General Register. Representative Curran, to your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I'll be brief. House File 3711 is the bill that would clarify the process that initiates hearings within the Court of Administrative Hearings through the Department of Human Rights, and I will turn it over to them for more details on the bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative. And please introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members. My name is Nico Bauer. I'm the Government Relations Director for the Minnesota Department of Human Rights. Just broadly speaking, this is a technical bill which does three primary things. First, it aligns the language of the Minnesota Human Rights Act to better reflect the hearing process laid out in Chapter 1400 of Administrative Rules. as well as reflect the court's recent rebrand from the Office of Administrative Hearings to the Court of Administrative Hearings. Second, it further clarifies the process and timeline for MDHR to initiate a case hearing with the Court of Administrative Hearings. And lastly, the bill would remove the language requiring that the hearing occur within the county where the alleged discrimination took place. Importantly, the process we are discussing today only occurs if parties are in a case are unable to reach a negotiated settlement following an MDHR determination. And this change would in no way foreclose a party's right to bring a lawsuit in district court at any point in the process. And I'll conclude by noting that this legislation has been reviewed by the Court of Administrative Hearings. And in 2020, the OLA report on MDHR recommended that the department and the legislature consider clarifying the statute to better reflect what actions the department would take following an unsuccessful settlement negotiation between parties. So with that, happy to field any questions.
Thank you for your testimony. Are there any members of the public wishing to testify on the bill? All right, we'll move to member discussion. Representative Engen.
Just one super quick question. I see in the struck language that the hearing shall be conducted at a place designated by the commissioner within the county where the unfair discriminatory practice occurred or where the respondent resides or has a principal place of business. So are we allowing for the appeals process to now be wherever you guys determine, or can you tell me a little bit about that?
Representative Curran, are you a testifier?
Madam Chair, Representative, so Chapter 1400 of Administrative Rules requires the department to propose a date and time and place for a hearing or pre-hearing, and in doing so, must consider the locations of the known parties, witnesses, and other participants. So the rules also allow for remote hearings if a party would have to travel more than 50 miles to attend a hearing. And there's my understanding is that the Court of Administrative Hearing has both virtual and telephone options for conducting hearings. So more flexibility in removing this language.
Mm-hmm. Representative Engen.
No problem.
Thank you. Any further discussion to the bill? Seeing none, Representative Curran renews her motion that HF 3711 be re-referred to the General Register. All those in favor?
Aye.
Yeah, okay. Opposed? Congratulations. The motion prevails and the bill is moved along.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
There being no other items on the agenda, correct? All right, the committee is adjourned.